You're listening to Lucid Cafe. I'm your host, Wendy Halley. Can change in a short period of time. It's been 3 weeks since I dropped the last episode, and in that brief window of time, COVID-19 has spread like wildfire, and most of the world is on lockdown. It's all so surreal, and yet here we are. Because so much of what we're dealing with right now is unknown, it's hard not to feel vulnerable and anxious and out of control. One of the challenges we can have is arm wrestling with our thoughts. As you know, your brain is equipped with a frontal lobe, which gives you the unique ability to think abstractly, to develop a sense of self and to ponder that sense of self in space and time, to contemplate the past and plan for the future. It's kind of a blessing and a curse, really, this frontal lobe of ours. The ability to think abstractly gives us the illusion that we have control over things that we don't, like the future, which isn't actually real. The future is a concept. It's a helpful one, but it's a concept. And this is the source of most of our anxiety, is wanting to believe you can control things that you actually can't control, like the future, because you can't control a concept. The frontal lobe is also the source of your imagination and creativity. These are definitely some of the most powerful tools we have for survival. We innovate. We dream up creative solutions and imagine possibilities and then make them real, like the Thighmaster and velour pants. And I think it's also worth mentioning that your DNA is imprinted with the strength and resilience of your ancestors. Hundreds of generations of your ancestors have survived despite unbelievable odds. Catastrophic natural disasters, famine, disease, war, and pandemics. Despite that, here you are. You would not exist if your ancestors didn't find a way to survive every challenge they faced. We don't know how this crisis is going to play out yet, but we have some incredible things going for us. The ability to adapt to any situation and to find creative ways to do that. There's a lot to be thankful for, like velour pants. One thing you absolutely can control is where you point all that brain power you have. You can point it towards powerlessness, fear, and anxiety, or in the direction of innovation, adaption, and possibility. And remember, anxiety is optional because the future isn't real. Like our most ancient ancestors understood, we exist in the dreaming of one giant moment. And during this perspective-building time we're collectively going through, today's episode seems like a timely one. Soon after completing her graduate studies in psychology, my guest, Dr. Sharon Prentice, found the world of secular psychology lacking. Her patients needed something more. She set out to investigate and explore alternative methods in the field of mental health that would incorporate that something special she believed existed in each and every individual soul. She is the author of the best-selling book, Becoming Starlight, A Shared Death Journey from Darkness to Light, which attempts to answer the question, is this all there is? And in our conversation, we address that question and a lot more. Please enjoy my conversation with Sharon Prentice. Well, Sharon, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
I love being here. I've been so looking forward to chatting with you and talking to you about what you do, what I do. Just the whole thing. So this is very cool. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. So you have this book that you released called Becoming Starlight.
Yes, ma'am.
Surviving Grief and Mending the Wounds of Loss.
Yes.
Powerful stuff. It's a memoir.
Uh-huh.
And the emphasis is on your, of course, your losses, your great losses in life, and your experience of having a shared death experience, which actually is not something I'm familiar with, and I don't know if a lot of people are familiar with. So it would be great if we could start out by you sharing a little bit about what that is and what that looked like for you.
Sure. It's really amazing. I had never heard of a shared death experience either. And after it happened to me, I searched far and wide to figure out what in the world this was. I knew it was a very real phenomenon, but I had no name for it. And the amazing thing was, the more I searched, the more people I found that said, oh yeah, I know what that is. I experienced that too. So I started building this network of people that had a shared death experience. Now, shared death experience is almost identical to the near-death experience. And I really think you'd have to be living under a rock to not know what a near-death experience was. The difference is, in the near-death experience, the person having that journey, that experience, has died or is dying or is in a coma-like state or something to that effect. Where the shared death experience is someone who, I say, they are just invited along to witness the after effects of physical death. It's a peek into foreverness to show you what's out there. There's nothing wrong with you. You're totally healthy. You can be at the bedside of the person that is dying, or you could be across the globe. I know people who are across the globe and had no earthly idea that something was happening to someone that they love, and they have been taken along. They have been invited along to witness this aftermath.
Really? So I was thinking that the experience that you had in reading your book, it could have been the byproduct of the extreme exhaustion and the emotional stress that you were experiencing, that I thought maybe that was a trigger for your experience. But what you're saying is that people can have it remotely and not even be aware.
Yes, absolutely. That surprised me too. People have asked me over and over again, why me? You know, why did this experience happen to me? And I so wish I had the answer to that, because if I did, I would shout it from the rooftop so everyone would know. Now, I have my own theory as to why it happened to me. And I think every single person that has some type of spiritual experience, it comes for something that they can possibly pinpoint in their life, or something they have absolutely no idea why this happened to them. So for me, I really think it was a three-pronged thing. And you hit on one of it, saying the absolute exhaustion, but it really went deeper than exhaustion for me. This all started when my daughter died. She lived for 2 hours after she was born, and she died in my arms. And at that moment in time, everything that I believed about the world, everything I believed about the universe, everything I believed about God, everything I had been taught since I was a child, just fell apart. Nothing made sense anymore. And I became angry and bitter and so full of rage, because I had nothing to hang on to, you know, and there was absolutely no one to talk to and no one who understood exactly what I was going through. And so all of this anger and this bitterness and this rage just went inside of me. And I became someone that I didn't even want to be near. And at the same time, my husband, who was an electronics warfare officer, was getting sick, and no one could find what was wrong with him. There was no diagnosis. There was nothing. But I was watching this 6'5", 200-something-pound man losing all this weight and getting weak and going down to absolutely nothing. And it took 8 years for them to finally diagnose him. And when they did, it ended up being pancreatic cancer.
Oh, man.
What had happened was, because of his work as an electronic warfare officer, his body had been bombarded with everything that a human body should never be bombarded with, and it caused such inflammation, and that inflammation eventually struck the pancreas, and then he ended up with cancer. And when that happened, I didn't think it was possible that I could become more rageful and more angry and more bitter, but that's exactly what happened. And I set up this, I call it an existential battle with God and with death, and I was going to beat them at their own games. And my control issues just got off the charts. You know, I figured if I could control everything that was happening in my life, then he wouldn't die. I'd already lost my daughter, and the thought of losing him, you know, would have just been too much. And then the day that he died, it was the tumors in his body started to break up and travel to his brain, and he left him unable to see and unable to hear and unable to feel. And it was such a traumatic thing for me, and I was battling God. You know that when you say exhaustion, it's such a battle when you don't really want to believe in anything, and yet you do want to believe in something. And having this ethereal thing, you know, that you can't see or touch or feel, having this war there and saying, I'm going to beat you, even though I don't believe in you. I know that doesn't make sense, but, you know, trauma does really weird things to people. So what happened is this went on all day long. And then that evening, our oncologist, who by then was a very good friend of ours, he asked me if I would get up out of the bed, because I had actually crawled into the bed with my husband and was just holding him, because it was the first time I could touch him in 6 months, because every nerve fiber in his body was on fire, and I didn't want to touch him because it caused him even more pain.
Oh, man.
Oh, it was horrible. So the doctor asked me, would I please get up so he could check his vitals just to see what was going on, because they everyone that was in the room, they knew what was going on. I was the only one that wouldn't admit what was happening. So I got up, went into the bathroom, and when I rounded the door to go into the bathroom, turned the light on, looked in the mirror, and then I heard my oncologist let out this word. I won't say it, because it's not a really good word that you use, you know, in a podcast.
Well, no, you could say whatever you want here.
Oh, okay, you can always edit it out. He said, what the fuck? I mean, you know, and I rounded that corner, ran like a banshee. I mean, I really did. And what had happened was medically impossible. Steve had rolled over. And I immediately went to the side of the bed so that I was facing him. And I knelt down in front of him, and we were nose to nose so I could see him. And his eyes were open. And I knew he could see me because I saw the light, you know, in his eyes. And I knelt down in front of him, and I was looking right at him, and I could feel the breathing, you know. And he was looking right at me. And then he spoke to me, which he was not supposed to be able to do. And everyone in the room just gasped. And I said to him, what are you staring at? You would think I'd say something that was so incredibly profound, because what was happening was not, no one could explain what was happening, you know?
Right, yeah.
And I said, what are you staring at? And he looked at me and he spoke to me and he said, I just want to remember. And when he did that, I, along with everyone else in the room, my parents were there, and the oncologist was there, and the nurse that I had hired, she was a private duty nurse helping me. All of us just, you know. And when I did that, I breathed in his breath. And I closed my eyes and I thought, I've won. You know, I won. I beat death. He's going to survive. And then I opened my eyes back up. It sounds like this took a long time, but it didn't. It was just a matter of seconds, you know. And I opened my eyes and I saw that his eyes had gone dark. And I knew then that I had lost, that he had died, and whatever this God thing was had beat me and had just been putting up, you know, with me. And it was at the moment of my husband's death, that moment altered my entire life, but not in the way that most people think it would, because it was at the moment of his death that I was invited along to witness what was happening to him. And my theory about why it happened to me has a lot to do with what you called exhaustion. I call it surrender. Because everything that I was, everything that I thought I was, all ego, all identity, all everything, I just surrendered it. You know, I just surrendered myself to whatever forces wanted to come take me, because at that point, there wasn't much left to me. I had nothing else to fight about. You know, and I did not have the strength. Exhaustion is a good word. It really is. I did not have the strength to fight anymore. And I just fell to the floor. But then I stood up. And I have said since the beginning that I stood up by some power that wasn't my own, because I had no strength. And then it all started to happen. The ceiling started turning to mist. The floor, you know, those ugly linoleum floors in hospitals started to disappear. And that was when I noticed the stars. They were just billions of them, Wendy, just billions and billions. I could see each of them distinctly. And yet they were all one big light, and they were coming to get me. You know, I just had this feeling that there was a presence among these stars, and I wanted to go there because I recognized it. it felt like home. I've described it as a long ago forgotten memory, you know, and I wanted to go there, and there was nothing that was going to stop me from going there. So I think what happened to me was that surrender, because at that moment of surrender, the people in the room said that this noise came out of me that to this day I couldn't tell you what it was, you know, what it sounded like. But I think what I did was tap into what the mystics call the heart of hearts and the sacred word. And that sacred word that people in deep, deep meditation or in the midst of some type of horrible trauma can tap into. And that takes you right to the foot of God. It takes you right to divinity. And I do call it God. A lot of people can call it source, creation, the universe, whatever they want to call it. My word for what it was God. And I think that sacred word, plus Steve getting to where he was saying to our creator, you know what, you got to throw this woman a bone, because if you don't, she's not going to survive this, you know. So I really think it was the surrender, Steve's love, asking God to take care of me, and God saying, all right, all right, all right, enough from you. I don't want to hear your crap anymore. Come see what's going on. And I think that's what happened to me.
The picture you painted in your, as you are recounting your, the events of your life that led up to this experience, really the pain, the anguish, you did a great job of capturing that in your memoir. Well, it seemed like you had to have that experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Because and that's one of the reasons that I believe that I formulated my own theory of why this happened to me. Without that, I honestly don't think that I could have survived the entire, everything that was going on, because losing that much, you know, there's a death order, okay? We all expect this death order, you know, our great-grandparents, our grandparents, our parents, you know, brothers and sisters, and no, you don't start with your first child. You know, you just don't.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, and then you don't start with your husband who's 33 years old, you know, and what was left of me was just reeling from all of this, thinking, how is this possible? I went from a girl who thought that if I did everything right, I said everything right, I walked the straight and narrow, and I was good and kind and generous, that everything would be fine. And it wasn't. It wasn't. And so when all of that fell away from me, I had nothing to hang on to, absolutely nothing. So what that experience did, it gave me back me, but it was a different me, Wendy. It was not that same, and I'm going to call her a little girl. I look back at that little girl now, and I'm so sad for her, you know, because she had nothing to believe in and nothing to hold on to. And the grief and the, it was despair. That's what it was. It was despair. And thank you so much for saying that I explained that in the book. You know, that one chapter on my daughter, that chapter took me almost 6 months to write, that one chapter.
Really?
Because it was like reliving the whole thing.
I bet.
And it was so vulnerable, and it was just pouring out of, you know, soul stuff, soul wounds. And it was very, very difficult to get that out on paper. And I would just sob while I was writing it. And my family would say, don't, you don't have to do this. And I would say, yes, I do. The reason I wrote Starlight, and you probably don't know this, I wrote the Starlight really for two reasons. One was because my daughter and my husband, no matter how short their lives were, they mattered. And their lives and their deaths affected so many people, so many in the community. We lived in a small community, and everybody knew exactly what was going on. So by the time I got home the next morning, everyone in the city knew what had happened. And so many of their lives were changed. And then because of what I do now, I am asked every day, should I be afraid? That's why the last chapter is entitled, Should I Be Afraid? I work with terminally ill patients and their families now. And I use my story to help alleviate some of the fear of what they're all feeling, because the biggest fear of those people who are losing their lives at the moment is, am I just going to disappear into nothingness? You know, what's out there? Where am I going? Even the most faithful among us, when they get that diagnosis, the fear of where am I going, what's going to happen to me? Because facing our own mortality is something that none of us want to do, none of us want to believe. And even worse than that, facing the mortality of those we love, that it, there's no place in our bodies to put the fact that we could lose our children. We could lose our husband or our wife. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to deal with it. So we don't. That's what I do. I go in and I help people address this fear. So every one of them have said to me for years, would you please write this down so that when we're not together, I have something that I can go back and read and remember. So that's why Starlight was born, to help them.
Beautiful.
Well, I had to do it. You know, it wasn't something that I just wanted to do. I had to do it.
That an obligation.
It was. You know, that experience changed absolutely everything for me.
Mm-hmm.
It altered my life in every single solitary way. That's why I said I can look back at pre-experience, you know, versus the second the experience was over.
Right.
And that girl that was so angry and bitter and so full of despair and anguish, that girl died that night.
You can't go through an experience like that and come out on the other side of it the same person. You transform. You can't help but have that happen.
That is very true. And, you know, I say it's a shortcut. Because a lot of the people that I deal with, they are on this spiritual journey. And most people think this a spiritual journey is a straight line, you know, from here to there. No, I've never known anybody that's gone on a spiritual journey that isn't in the middle of a whirlwind. You know, the ups and the downs and the dark nights of the soul.
Right.
You've got to go through all of that, you know. And it's one of those things that you need to question. And I love it when people start questioning the traditions that they were born into, because that's the beginning of the awakening to that divinity, that divine heart of hearts, you know, so you can say, this is who I am. This is who I really am, not who you were told you were. And discovering that God is not this outside, I call him the Charlton Heston of, you know, God is, a, you know what I'm saying, Charlton Heston in the Ten Commandments, you know, that dude?
Uh-huh.
That was my version of God growing up. That's what he looked like, you know? And that was so just, you know, I look back at it now and I think, seriously? I so missed the mark. But that's what I believed. And finding out that God, I am his very breath, that I exist because I am his thought, that all started that. I wouldn't even known to think something like that until I had this experience and I realized that I am that very, very, that breath of him and that thought of him. And that takes you on an amazing journey. So when I see my people, I am a psychologist, but I am also a certified spiritual counselor. I went to the American Institute of Healthcare Professionals because they offer a fantastic program to become a certified spiritual counselor, because I absolutely believe that you cannot be healthy unless your psychological, emotional, physical, and spiritual are all in balance. And what I have discovered, as I discovered for myself, is that when the spiritual goes down, the entire system crashes. And that's why I do what I do. It's fun. It's interesting. It's sad. It rips your guts out. But I decided, no, I didn't decide. It just, I had to do it, that I was going to be that person that other people could come talk to, because I didn't have anybody.
Well, I think that's a really common experience, that those of us who end up having some kind of transpersonal, highly spiritual, surprising experience that just turns your life inside out, that there's no rule book or handbook for this, and you feel really alone. When I was reading your book, I was thinking about, back in 1998, I had my very first spontaneous visionary experience.
Oh my gosh.
And I was a few years out of graduate school for clinical psychology. So
there you go. Okay. So you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
When I say the secular is not enough. Absolutely. Good for
right.
you.
Right. So I have this experience, and as I was reading your book, I was thinking, I wonder if my experience was a shared death experience or a version of it. But let me tell you, the experience was with someone I was not aware of, It was with somebody I didn't know. I didn't know who this person was, but it was a waking dream. And I found myself looking out of the eyes of a woman who I didn't know. I was inside. It's like a vicarious hitchhiker. I was in her being, and I was being escorted down this hallway by two guards, and she was in shackles. And she was a young white woman, and I knew that she was being led to her execution. I went through the death experience with her as her body got electrocuted in the electric chair.
Oh my gosh.
Just on a Saturday morning, you know.
Hello, Saturday. What are you doing today?
It was such an unusual. I still don't quite understand why that particular experience happened.
But you will one day.
Well,
you will one day.
Only because I don't have a connection with her, but that I had subsequent visionary experiences that did feel more personal. That one just never felt personal, but yeah, I'm hoping someday it'll make some sort of sense. But it was a shared death experience.
Yeah,
only I was in her body and having the experience as if I were her. It's really trippy.
That is amazing. And I'm racking my brain right now trying to, I have heard of experiences like this, and it's not exactly a shared death experience. It's actually a little bit more than a shared death experience, because in the shared death experience, you don't become, you know, that other person. They don't inhabit your body. So you definitely had something that was even more intense. You really did, watching, and not just watching, but being that person.
Yeah, I had access to her thoughts, her memories, a little bit of her memories at the time.
I'm wondering if it was like a past life. You see where my brain's going, you know?
The subsequent ones were.
Yeah.
I recognized them as people I had been. But the first
yeah,
one...
Yeah, this is what I'm thinking. No, it didn't. Wow.
So,
did you research at all? And was there any way you could...
Wouldn't that just be awesome if you could find this person?
I suspect that this person is still alive and is on death row in Tennessee. Possibly. Possibly.
Oh,
but...
my. Gosh.
What this whole experience opened up
wow.
for me was I ended up venturing onto the shamanic path.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Amazing. Good
that
for
door,
you.
I didn't know at the time that that door was being opened, but that's what ended up happening. But like I said, as I was reading your book, I was thinking like, well, I wonder if it was a version of a shared death experience because I...
Yeah, it could be. I all the people that I have talked to around the globe that have had the shared death experience, none of them has said that they became the other person. Well, you know what? I'm going to talk to some people and I'm going to find out what this is. And I'm going to let you know what some of, you know, Raymond Moody's a very good friend of mine and everybody knows Dr. Raymond. He's such a sweetheart. I'm going to call him this afternoon and I'm going to say, hey, have you ever heard of this? Because if anybody has, he has.
All right. No, I'd love to hear.
Yeah, that would be very cool.
Me too. Folks, I will report back in a future episode if Sharon lets
yeah.
me know.
That, yeah, I'm definitely going to find that out because that's absolutely amazing.
So getting back to your story, I would love to learn more about how it is you work with folks. Now, you talked about being a psychologist and a spiritual counselor.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep.
How do you work with people?
I am usually the one that's called in after someone receives the medical diagnosis. Started out really in graduate school. It started out where my professors would say, hey, you know, there's this doctor up at Georgetown, because we're right outside of DC. And, you know, they want to talk about death and dying and grief and all. And I just kind of wandered, you know, in the halls, and I talked to the chaplains there and the other physicians. And then they said, you know what, I've got this patient who's really afraid. Will you go in and talk to them? And this is when I was still in graduate school. So I'm like, sure, I'll be more than glad to go in and talk to them. And that led to the family members coming in and all of us talking together and then me being invited to their homes, you know, for home hospice and you know, hospice and then the centers and hospitals and private practice and all of these people wanting to talk about what's going to happen. It just happened so organically. I didn't plan it. Nobody really planned it. It just kind of happened.
But it makes sense.
And then my practice just grew. I'm by referral only now because I can't possibly see everybody that, you know, wants to talk about this. And I've helped train a lot of people into talking about these things, because a lot of the MDs, they come in, they say, okay, here you go. If there's anybody you know that should get here, you need to get them here. And the discussion, anything to do with a discussion about death and spirituality, the MDs don't want to touch that, except the surgeons and the other people like in the operating rooms and things like that, because the stories that they have to tell.
Really?
Oh my gosh, they are absolutely phenomenal, the things that they have. So do you know that in some operating rooms, they actually put things on the ceiling and, you know, little notes on the ceiling and underneath the tables.
I have heard that for people who are having out-of-body experiences, they can report back.
Yep, they actually do that.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. Well, you know, I too believe, and I'm sure you do too, that there's not a person in this world that has not had some type of spiritual experience. They're either denying it, they don't want to deal with it because they don't know what it is.
Or they've rationalized it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, and I think that the more people talk about these things, the more open-minded they are to accepting the fact that these things are real. Because, I mean, even the atheists and the agnostics that I have, we always get into the talk about energy and consciousness, you know, and things like that. And if I can get them scientifically, we always get to the point, you know, where energy doesn't die and consciousness, it's just there. And they have to then admit, and you know, what a possibility these spiritual experiences really are. And once you can get into that, that makes my job so much easier to help take away some of this fear, you know, that people have. And then we just talk. And if I can get people talking, that's the thing. Because I don't, as a clinical psychologist yourself, you know that sometimes there are emotions, feelings that there are no words for. You know, they get stuck inside. And my job is to help people find those words, because that is your chance. When someone that you love is transitioning, okay, that is your chance to say and do all the things that you need to say, because you don't want to have the coulda, woulda, shouldas, you know, and the regrets of why didn't I do this and why didn't I do that and why didn't I say this and why, you know, why wasn't I kinder and why wasn't I there, and letting them know that it's okay to laugh. It's okay to talk about memories. It's okay to watch a television show. I mean, it's okay to do these things. And then after the person has transitioned, then it's my job to let them know, because if the coulda, woulda, shouldas do show up, the people that have passed, they don't care about that stuff anymore. They just want to know that the people they love are happy. And in the midst of the grief, there has to be gratitude. You know, and that's what I tell people. Even though your heart has been ripped out of your body, I don't want you to live in the grief of the moment. I want you to live in the gratitude of having had an amazing life with that person. You know, so making that transition for the family is the only thing that helps them to be able to move on and thrive like the person that they've lost would want them to do.
Yeah, regret is... it's poison. It's poison for the person who's dying, and it's poison for the people,
absolutely,
the loved ones left behind if they have any regrets. If you can address that or prevent that from happening.
Well, yeah, that's a big deal, you know, because when someone has those regrets and they're living in the notion that if they become happy, if they start to experience gratitude, if they start to move on and move out of the grief a little bit, or if the grief changes, you know, from that intense grief, that somehow they are losing that person all over again. I deal with a lot of parents who have lost children that think, I can't smile again. I can't laugh again, because if I do, I am betraying my son or my daughter. And really, it's the exact opposite. You know, and the child, which I got to tell you too, just as an aside, I have learned more from children as they lay dying than I've ever learned from any adult. They're closer to heaven than we are. You know, they haven't been as stigmatized and as we get the farther, you know, we move along the line. But especially with the parents, getting them to understand that living in that moment of death, that is what your child would not want for you. You're not losing them all over again. You're bringing them home when you start to live outside of the grief and start living in the gratitude of their life.
Beautiful.
Well, you know.
So what kinds of things have you learned from children?
You know, I tell people, if you are capable, I wasn't capable. Of course, I didn't have the chance because my daughter was only a couple hours old. But I tell people, if you are capable of standing beside your child's bed and opening your heart to listen to what they are saying to you. Children are so wise. And like I said, they are closer to the truth of creation. And so many kids have said, Mommy, Daddy, it's okay. Here's where I was. Here's what I'm seeing. Here's what I'm being told. I saw Grandma.
So they start seeing glimpses.
Yes, all of these. Remember I said I recognized this place?
It's familiar.
It was home, and I knew it. And, you know, when I was there, I saw Steve, and I knew he was going to go be with our daughter, and it was okay. And as he started moving away from me, I didn't feel grief anymore. I almost wanted to say, will you just hurry up and go so you can pick Stephanie up and hold her? You know, this was what I was feeling. And for parents to really listen to what their kids are saying and get that glimpse, you know, the glimpse that I got, unfortunately, is not given, you know, to everyone. I'm no special than anybody else. This is just something that was given to me for whatever the reason. I mean, I came up with my own theory, but who knows? I could be totally off, but it works for me. But to hear it from a child who is so close and having those glimpses and listening to the things that they are saying to you and allowing them into your brain, that's the thing, opening your mind enough to realize that we don't see it all the time. People ask me, how come they're not coming to me? And I say to them, they probably are. It's not that they're having a hard time getting through to us. It's that we're denying the possibility. So it's us that are keeping a lot of these spiritual things out because we don't want to end up in the loony bin. You know what I mean?
I actually do.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to be careful who you tell. Not so much anymore. But in the past, you had to be careful who you say these things to because they look at you like, I'm going to give you some Haldol. You need to rest for a while.
Yeah.
You know, fortunately, that's going away more and more and more, but it is still pretty much out there in mainstream psychiatry and medicine. But little by little, it's starting to go away.
Yes, that's good to hear.
Yes, thank you, God. You know, we deny the fact and we don't understand it. I mean, this human condition of ours, we don't really understand that. This may sound a little woo-woo, but you'll understand what I'm saying. We really are all so connected to this, what I call this thought of God, because we are all those thoughts. We are all that one breath. You know, so what happened to you, maybe you tapped into that breath, that thought that was meant to be her. You know, this girl that you inhabited for a while, or she inhabited you. Maybe you somehow tapped into that thought and that breath that was her thought. But yours combined with that, because we are all just one great big conglomeration of this amazing creation. It's that thought. It's that breath.
Some of my most profound and transformative experiences have taken place in some of my more advanced shamanic training when I got to explore this territory that I call home too. This, we call it the upper worlds in the shamanic frame.
Right.
But it's what a mind-expanding experience to be able to go to this place and connect with your higher self, your oversoul, whatever you want to call it, and to be able to have a kind of an understanding of the terrain of where you go and the familiarity of the place. It feels so like, all right, I remember this place.
Yes, yes. And you know, that's why in the book, I call it That Place. I purposely don't call it heaven. And people have asked me, why don't you call it heaven? And there's a very specific reason.
What's that?
Why I don't call it heaven. Because when you say the word heaven, what do you think of?
I think of the Christian Bible.
You got it. You think of this place with the, you know, the mansions and the gold lined streets and the diamonds and the blah, blah, blah.
And the gate.
The gate. And St. Peter's standing there. Okay. That's why I don't say heaven.
Yeah.
Because I did not want anyone. Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I don't want people to go to their preconceived notion or the things that they, mm-hmm. that their tradition taught them their whole life, because that is absolutely not what I found.
How I perceive it, it looks nothing like that.
Nothing.
I don't perceive it in the way that it's depicted.
You know, it's funny. That is the one thing that has caused me more, let's put it this way. There has been more debate among my colleagues and, you know, people who really want to get into that particular chapter called That Place, the concept of heaven and hell. Because people say to me, okay, we see what you say about so-called heaven. Now, where's hell? And my response to that is, hell is wherever God is not. And the fact that God is everywhere means that hell, is hell a human concept to control? And you see where I'm going with that?
Yeah.
You know?
I think it resides in suffering, right?
Absolutely. And this is one of the things, and especially if I follow my truth from what I found, why on earth would a God, creator, source, use your own word, take his very thought and his very breath and condemn it to some everlasting burning, you know, place that it doesn't make any sense. It is an absolute waste of energy and thought. It, to me, it makes no sense. It is something that I think we do to ourselves in the separateness and the isolation that we bring upon ourselves because of whatever. I did it out of rage and anger and bitterness. And when my world fell apart, it was a, how can you do this to me? You know, you can't do these things to me. I'm special. I was good all my life. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it felt personal.
It did. And there was nothing personal about this. I think God was out to get me. No, I wasn't. You know, and I tell people now, life and death, you know what? It's all part of the same deal.
Yep.
It's all part of the same deal. We just don't want to see it. But then when we have to see it, it's like, whoa, what happened?
So you buy into the idea of reincarnation?
You know, here's the thing about reincarnation with me. I don't know.
That's a fair answer.
I honestly don't know, because if I go back to what I found about me, that I am that extremely unique thought of God, and that God breathed that breath into that thought. When that thought is no longer necessary on this earth, and God decides, I'm going to take that back. What then happens? Is there another thought that is like me? Or I honestly don't believe that it's the same thought and the same breath that made me who I am in, you know, in this particular world to express God's thought the way I express it. Getting any farther than that, I have trouble with. It's not that I discount it, but I have trouble with it. And I am by absolutely no means an expert on it or even pretend to know that much about it, but it's fascinating to me.
It is, right?
It's fascinating. I just don't know enough about it. I've talked to a lot of people about it, that, you know, the ones that say you keep going and going and going until you get it right. But then for me, that rings to the, that goes right to the heart of what I say, that if I am that thought of God, and then when he calls me home, that thought is finished, or has that thought not been completed, then he has to send that back. See what I'm saying? It's just a circular thing for me that I don't really have an answer to.
Well, and I think that's a fair response. I can only speak to my experience and what my experience has shown me. And of course, take everything I say with a grain of salt.
We all, yeah. I mean, we have to ourselves, you know.
When I encountered my oversoul or my higher self in the dream time, when I would go on these journeys, I saw within it the reflection of all these different identities. So it was like a collective of all these identities. And in that, it had great wisdom because it had all of these lifetimes of experience.
Yeah.
And the tradition I study, the foundation of my shamanic practice, is in the Hawaiian or Polynesian tradition.
Very cool.
And they believe we have three souls.
Three.
Not one, yeah, but three. And the Oversoul, the higher self, is one of them.
That reminds me of what are those books? Oversoul 7, the Seven Chronicles. Those are some of the first books I read.
Yep.
Looking for answers. Some of the first books.
Yeah, it's very similar to that. So the Hawaiians, or actually indigenous people in general, would say that your Oversoul is dreaming you into existence.
Oh my God, I like that. And then what are the others?
They're there as a collective. It's like an archive of all of the wisdom of their life experiences.
That makes total sense.
I don't see reincarnation as this sort of ongoing until you get it right kind of thing, because that's a very human concept, the right and wrong. To me, it's just you're here to have experience.
Right.
And your Oversoul is having this journey through eternity.
Oh my God.
It's having all these different experiences.
Yeah.
And it's not easy being on this planet. It's tough.
Oh, God. That, you know, when I think of reincarnation, I think, seriously, I so don't want to do this again. You know, I mean,
But the part of you that's making that decision, if you want to put it that way, your Oversoul complex, is not human.
Right.
To me, it's pure consciousness.
Yes. Because that's what survives. I do believe that. It's the consciousness that survives. People have asked me that before. Is it your physical whatever? And I'm like,
I'm with you.
No, it is your consciousness.
I'm with you. I actually think the spirit world, the dream time, whatever you want to call it, I believe that is consciousness.
Yes, I'm right there with you, kiddo, because that's the thing. That is what I found. That is what makes sense. And when I talk about it or write about it, that's hard because it's extremely difficult to put into words.
Tell me about it.
Okay, you can't, there are no words. I do believe in this human condition, we're not supposed to have the words to totally be able to absolutely define adequately what these experiences are like. So we have to use what's at our disposal. And
that's right.
You know.
Because it's a non-human experience.
Absolutely.
And so to put it into the framework of your human mind is very challenging.
Yes, it is.
And words fail.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And I found that when I was writing Becoming Starlight, because no, that's not the right word. That's not the right word.
Right.
And I would pull out a thesaurus and I would ask people, what's a good word for this? And I'd already thought of that word and discarded it because it just wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
So then you come up with this string of words, you know, the magnificent, the blah, 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 blah. And it still wasn't enough. And finally, I'm like, oh, God, you know, what am I even doing? But it's that consciousness thing that rings so true. But to describe it, you have to use physical words. So it comes out, you know, people have said to me, was it your physical body? Was it his physical body? No, but it.
But there's like an essence there that you know. That his identity is
there.
A part of it. It is.
Yeah.
It's a very strange thing to try to put into words.
Yeah. It's almost impossible. So you just have to do what you can do. Mm-hmm. And
but you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. There is. I, Wendy, and I'm sure you would go along with this because of what you experienced. I was more me at that moment than I have ever been or ever will be. And you know why? Because I didn't have to be anybody. There was no ego. There was no having to prove myself. There was no having to impress anybody. There was no, to go through every emotion that a human being could go to, every emotion, the good, the bad, the ugly, to get to a point where you're almost numb, where all you have to do is just be, that's who you are. And that, to me, was this pure consciousness meeting this creator of mine saying, there you are, there you are.
And, well said.
You know, that is the truth that I found. And it didn't fit with my family tradition. Thank God my mom and dad were in that room because they knew, they could tell something was happening because my oncologist, they really thought something bad had happened to me because he was up checking my pulse and he had a stethoscope on me and all that because my heart rate and everything just dropped to the floor. They knew something was happening. So when I came back with this story, the first thing I said, which was so unexpected to everybody, and got my in-laws very angry at me after I was, I'm going to say lucid again or whatever the word is, I said, that was the most awesome experience I ever had. but they took it out of context, meaning my son just died.
Yeah, they didn't understand what you just went through. Yeah.
And they're saying, it was awesome. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. That, and even to this day, because I'm with an awful lot of people when they die, I have to be careful because my first response is to smile. And the reason I want to smile is because my first thought is now
they they're free.
No, they are there. Now they know. So I will excuse myself from the room and let the family be alone, and I'll go back in, you know, like in 5 minutes or whatever. And because you can't stand there and smile when someone's heart has been ripped out of their body. But that is my first response, is that you got them now. They're there. They know.
It seems like your whole kind of MO is about making friends with death.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, it's so funny because that's excellent that you picked up on that, because people think I'm a major whack job because of the way I look at death. I don't look at it. You know, death is not that, you know, 18-foot character in the black robe with the sickle, you know, like you see at Halloween.
The Grim Reaper.
You got it. And people are so afraid of death. But, you know,
we don't talk about it.
We don't talk about it. We don't deal with it. We run from it. We hide from it as if it's never going to cross our doorstep. And that's why I said it's a when, not an if. And understanding, so I said earlier that death is part of life. It's not anything, honestly, it's not anything to be afraid of. Yes, it's going to hurt us, and yes, it's going to rip our heart out, especially if it's our child. And it's, you know, you will never recover from that. And a lot of psychologists will tell you, oh, well, you're going to find closure or whatever. I never use that word. I do not agree with closure. I think closure is a myth, and all closure does, if you look for it, it grounds you in the very thing you're trying to get rid of, you know?
That's a great point, yeah.
And I do not look for that, and I so wish that the psychological community would stop putting that out there, because people misunderstand anyway what they think it is. They go into the five stages, you know, the Kubler-Ross, and they think that is going to refer to the family members, when really it refers to the person who is passing away.
Right.
And you cannot take that and extrapolate it one to the other. And that's what people do. So I try to get people to understand that death is this thing that, it's not that you should greet it with open arms, because a lot of people think if you do that, it's giving up hope and it's giving up joy and it's giving up love. But it's not. It's understanding our mortality. And so making friends with the fact that we are mortal, you know what that does? Helps you live. It's a funny thing. I was scrolling through Instagram the other day and I just stopped dead, because I saw this, I don't know what you call these things. Somebody had taken a quote of mine that I had done in an interview a year ago and made it into a, what are those called, a meme or something? And what it was I had said in this interview, I learned the hard way that to live in fear of death brings with it the unexpected consequence of living in fear of life.
I can see why they made a post of that.
Well, it just shocked me, because to tell you the truth, I'd forgotten I even said that, you know, but I just jolted, you know, when I saw that. So I reached out to him and I was like, where'd you find that? And he says, that has changed my life. And I'm like, well, thank you so much. That makes me feel so blessed that somebody, that something I said resonated with somebody. And he said that he had made it into a poster, you know, one of the mini posters, and taped it up on his bathroom mirror. And every morning when he gets up, he reads that. So that when he goes out into the world, he realizes that if you fear death, you are not going to live out loud and you are not going to live fully. So making friends with death helps you make friends and live life.
Well, holy shit.
Hey girl, we understand each other. You know, this is soul sister stuff here. You know, we both had the soul wounds. We both had these experiences, and it changes you in a way that you recognize it in someone else.
Absolutely. Well, this conversation has been thoroughly enjoyable for me.
Yes, I love talking to someone that gets me and doesn't think this woman is like, you know, Looney Tunes.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that feeling.
Yeah, but I'll accept it. I'll accept it and go about my way and do what I do and help whomever happens to come my way. And I know you do the same thing.
Certainly try.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all we can do. You know, that's all we can do.
Thank you so much.
This is great, Wendy. Thanks for having me. I've loved this. And I'm going to look up this, send me somewhere, give me a book, give me something to where I can learn more about these three souls that the Hawaiians believe in. You have turned on this bulb that I want to learn now. I'm a forever student.
Absolutely. I think we all should be. So how can people find you?
Oh my gosh. My website is www.sharonprentice.com. You can reach me through that. Social media, of course, Instagram. Let's see, what else? Twitter. I have what they call my professional Facebook page. There's like 35,000 of us on there now. That happened like almost overnight.
Wow.
People send me private messages all the time. And can you talk about this? Can you talk about that? And so what I did, I can't respond to everyone individually. And so I will write, you know, a generalized answer, because people all deal with the same things. Everyone thinks they're so unique. And I hate to tell you, but you're not. You know, and that's Sharon Prentice, PhD. So they can get me there, and they can find Becoming Starlight anywhere.
Okay, know? And I'll put all the links in the show notes so people can access you easily.
That'd be great. And I respond to everyone, okay? Like I said, on the generalized thing on my Facebook page. But I feel that if people take the time to reach out to me, I'm not going to give them to somebody else for that person to respond to them. Do it myself. So it takes a little bit of time, but I eventually get to everybody.
Oh, that's beautiful. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Wendy. It was great.
Loved chatting with Sharon, and we plan to do it again in the near future. She's working on a new book that sounds pretty amazing, so stay tuned for more Sharon Prentice. In the meantime, if you'd like to learn more about Sharon, please visit her website, sharonprentice.com, or you can connect with her on Facebook and Twitter. If you're enjoying the show, please consider making a one-time or monthly donation using the link in the show notes or on the podcast page of my website. You can also support Lucid Cafe by subscribing to make sure that you never miss an episode, giving it a positive review, or letting others know about the show. However you support the show, please know that my gratitude is immense. Until next time, wishing you good health.